watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On talks previously aired on the show, Mike Parenti and others have made the point that great wealth causes great poverty. This week, we'll see how that works in practice as we look at debt in America. Financial services, credit cards, mortgages, and other banking are among the most profitable sectors in the U.S. economy. Part of that profit comes from a transfer of money from those with the least money to begin with. This week, we'll hear excerpts from a conference, Debt Matters, Raising the Profile of Household Debt in America, put on by the Center for American Progress, a think tank in Washington, D.C. John Taylor Gatto readings are still on vacation, but they'll be back, I promise. The conference focused on presenting the facts with an eye to reform on the policy level. While reforms can address some of the worst excesses, the underlying problem remains, the economic system itself. The presenters don't go there, though. That's considered unrealistic by those who wish to be considered credible in policy circles. We'll begin with what the numbers show about credit card debt.
I'm Tamara Drought. I work at Demos. We're located in New York, and what I'm going to do today is run quickly through some survey findings of a national household survey we did in March 2005 with our partner, the Center for Responsible Lending. But before I dive into that, one of the things I want to give you some context, and that is we had been looking at the rise in credit card debt over the last decade using the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finance data, which is sort of the creme de la creme data set for looking at wealth, assets, and liabilities. That said, it's very limited in terms of what it could actually tell us about what credit card debt looks like among households. We couldn't answer basic questions like how long is the average household in debt for? What are they doing to get out of debt? What has been the impact of this debt? Why are they going into debt? And so after sort of exhausting the analysis using the Fed data, we decided it was time to actually get some new data and dig a little deeper into the credit card debt problem, which, as Derek mentioned, we're looking at $813 billion in debt, half of all households that have credit card debts, which is almost half of all households in America, actually revolve their balances. So this is a huge issue that we still are only beginning to understand as we move forward. The household survey, as I said, was done a little over a year ago. We surveyed a little over 1,000 households. We looked at low to middle income households that were in credit card debt for 3 months or longer. We chose 3 months to make sure we weren't getting people who just happened at the time that we called to be revolving a balance, but really wanted to make sure we were getting credit card debtors. And we defined low to middle income as anybody who had half to 120% of their local median income. Now, basically, that's a third of all low to middle income households with that income range. And if you project that out into the population, that's about 41 million people representing 15 million households. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things, the major topics that the survey covered was the amount of credit card debt, the length of time in debt, reasons for being in debt, what households were doing to get out of debt, what their plan was, and what some of the consequences were of having this credit card debt. The mean of the sample was a little over $8,000, which is about what you get when you look at the aggregate data put out by the Federal Reserve. The median was around $5,000. The report, which is available on our website and the Center for Responsible Lending's website, goes into a lot more detail. You can look at these statistics by age, by income, by race. I'm really just going to give you very, very general information. How was this debt distributed? What we found was that about a third of households had pretty high credit card debt in that they had over $10,000 in credit card balances. Another third had pretty low credit card debt. They had under $2,500 in credit card debt, and then the rest fell somewhere in between. Now, obviously, whether $10,000 or $2,500 is low or high depends on that household's income. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that as we get further in. We wanted to get a sense of whether people's amount of credit card debt at this time was higher than it was a year ago or 3 years ago. Was it about the same, or was it lower? And what we found is, compared to 3 years ago, about 45% reported that their credit card debt had gone down, and then about 42% said it had gone up. So about the same amount were reporting greater and lesser amounts of credit card debt, and then a little more than 10% said it had stayed the same. We also asked the same question using the time period of 1 year ago, and the results were pretty similar. So how long is the average indebted household in debt? About 3.5 years. One of the important things to know about this is we also asked, how long do you think it's going to take you to get out of debt? The average response was 5 years. So if you and note that most people underestimate how long it's actually going to take them to get out of debt. So you're looking at about 8.5 years of carrying credit card debt of on average, $8,000. So why are households going into debt? I get plasma screen TVs a lot. And it's sort of like Dr. Warren was mentioning, the microwave oven. My experience has been it's the plasma screen TV, and it's always said that way. You know, young people today just got to have the plasma screen TV. Well, it turns out that isn't really what's happening, which was not too much of a shock to me. But what was a surprise were that car repairs came in as the top reason cited for why people were going into credit card debt. This also came up a lot in our focus group findings, so it was good that it got picked up in the survey. Home repairs and major household appliance repairs, meaning things like heating, water, hot water tanks. And I always joke that this is the one time when I look at these survey results about why people are going into credit card debt that I'm glad that I live in New York City, so I don't own a car or a home. Illness, medical expenses, that comes up time and again. It was a reason for a third of the respondents for having credit card debt. And then a layoff for job expense and college tuition and expenses. Nearly half of the people in the survey, let me just go back to that, mentioned three or more of these reasons as contributing to their credit card debt. Only 12% didn't mention any of these reasons, and I think that 12% probably reflects people who use credit cards for plasma screen TVs and nice vacations. We wanted to get a better sense of whether the anecdotal stories we had heard about families relying on credit cards to pay the groceries, pay the rent, was indeed something that was happening in a significant fashion. And indeed, what we found when we asked households if any time over the last year they had used credit cards to fund basic living expenses, which we defined as the rent, the mortgage, the utilities, or groceries, a third answered that they had. When we asked how long they had used credit cards in that fashion, the average number of months was 4 out of the last year. The median was 3. So back to this notion of how high is a high level of debt. It really matters. You really need to look at the amount of credit card debt a household has compared to their income. So what we did is we wanted to get a sense of what is a predictor of having a relative high level of credit card debt compared to your income. What we found was that you could predict having a high level of debt by knowing if that house had reported a layoff or a major medical expense. Those were the two big significant predictors of that household having a high relative level of credit card debt compared to their income. Go a little further, the reason why those households that report a layoff or a medical expense have higher relative credit card debt is because those are the third of households that tend to be using credit cards for basic living expenses in the past year. Now, we all know about the refinance boom that has finally, I think, come to a slow close, where about $500 billion was drained out of homeowner equity in a period of 3 years, roughly. And indeed, the survey respondents in our survey were no exception. About 40% of the homeowners had refinanced their home in the last 3 years, and half of those homeowners had used money to pay off credit card debt. And they paid off a significant amount of credit card debt. Now, keep in mind, they still have credit card debt because they're in our survey. But they reported that on average they had paid about $12,000 of their credit card debt bills. But at the time of the survey, they still had $14,000 in credit card debt, which is higher than the overall average in the sample. What this tells us is that homeowners that are using equity to try and pay down their credit card bills are in a more vulnerable position in that they had very high levels of credit card debt to begin with. And if we hadn't had the refinancing boom, we probably would have had higher averages reported in this survey. We asked people if their debt was a burden for them, if it worried them, and about half said it was a pretty serious burden, and then half said somewhat serious, not serious. But then we asked some questions to get a sense of whether this household was in distress, and indeed, nearly half of the people with credit card debt had been called by bill collectors. They might have been called by bill collectors for another reason other than the credit card debt, but this is a pretty good indication that these households are under distress if they're at the point where half are being called by bill collectors. Similar to that, just under half reported that they had been late or had missed a payment at least once in the last year. So what does this mean to be a household in credit card debt? I want to talk a little bit about the industry practices, because living with debt means living in a very deregulated, capricious environment in which the power between the borrower and the lender has become very, very unequal. And there's one sentence, it might be a fragment if there's any grammarians. Open up the next solicitation you get in the mail. In this statement, basically says it all about where we are in terms of the rights of borrowers and the rights of lenders. That is, today, as it clearly states in your solicitation in bold 8 or 9 or 10 point type, that the credit card companies reserve the right to change the APR or the terms of your account at any time for any reason. That's not really much of a contract. So what does that mean, the ability to change the terms at any time for any reason? What that means in practice is universal default policies, which have been talked about already. That's when you're late on a card Y, card X preemptively raises your interest rate. It also means that when the interest rate is raised on your credit card, whether that's because it gets switched from a fixed to a variable rate, or the prime rate goes up, or you're in the penalty zone because you were a minute late on a payment, that interest rate increase doesn't just apply from that point going forward. It applies to your entire existing balance. So to put some numbers on that, if you were carrying a $5,000 balance at 12.99% APR, which is a pretty decent rate, pretty normal, and you are a day late on a payment, so they jack your rate up to 29.99%, which is the standard penalty interest rate. That's going to result in extra interest payments of $1,550 in just 1 year on that balance. The other thing that's happened, which I touched on, is there's no grace period for late payments. It used to be that the credit card companies would give you 10 to 15 days until they'd impose a penalty or an interest rate increase for being late. Today, it's zero. You can be 5 minutes late. It's due on the date at 1 or 2 p.m. And then just an enormous growth in the kinds and level of fees that are now charged. We've talked a lot about solutions, actually, at this conference. I want to say just a few things about that. One, and the way we've been thinking about this is that we have to both cut off the demand for this type of credit card. What has really become, as the title of the report says, a plastic safety net. And we also have to deal with the supply side, which is the reality that we have millions and millions of households in credit card debt that do not have a fair shot of digging out of that debt because of the industry practices. So what do I mean by address the demand side? Enhanced savings incentives. That's been talked a lot about at this conference, and it's exactly something we need to do. But we also need to better protect against increased income volatility, which is the reality of living in today's labor market. That means things like wage insurance, deepening our unemployment insurance, and then finally, health insurance. The issue of underinsurance and uninsurance and spiraling out of control medical costs is woven throughout this entire credit card debt story. The other thing we need to do is reform the credit card industry. There are some real common sense approaches that would protect borrowers and level the playing field between the borrower and the lender, and I think there are three fundamentally important ones. One, eliminate universal default practices. Two, limit the rate of penalty rate increases. If you want to penalize people, fine, but 130% increase on your interest rate is excessive. I think most people can agree that that is excessive by any measure. And finally, prohibit interest rate increases from being applied retroactively, which essentially raises the cost of any good and service that was purchased with the credit card at the time.
Tamara Drought of Demos, a nonpartisan public policy research and advocacy organization. Next, material from a panel, Overview of Household Debt.
My name is Christian Weller. I'm a senior economist here at the center. And I want to go through a few numbers to set the stage for our first panel. The numbers are just simply staggering. For the first time in the data, we see, for instance, that for the typical household, the debt that they owe is larger than the incomes they have. But I think a more telling number, for me at least, and for most economists, is the debt service. You got to remember, interest rates have fallen to the lowest levels in decades, and yet the debt service, the share of income that families have to dedicate to repaying their loan, are at the highest on record. And they have gone up, in particular, for middle-class families. We issued a report earlier in May called Drowning in Debt. And I think the story of the rise in debt for the last few years is really the story of middle-class struggles. If you go through the numbers, and as I said, like for me, the more telling numbers, debt service payments, what you find is that that now middle-class families, middle-income families, white families, single men, are now beginning to struggle as much under the financial burden as other families. Doesn't mean that other families are not struggling, haven't struggled in the past, but now others are basically catching up in that regard. And that largely is a story, at least from the data we see, of rising needs to borrow amid stagnant wages, sharply rising prices for big ticket items such as housing, healthcare, college education, and easy access to credit for many families. If you look at the other ends of the spectrum, what you see is lower income families. You definitely see the need to borrow, the same kind of economic struggles, but there the access is somewhat restricted because many of them aren't homeowners, so they're ending up borrowing against credit cards and falling very much, very quickly into a vicious cycle of credit. On the higher end, you find the opposite. There easy access exists to credit, but for high income families, the need to borrow is just not as large. They have actually seen increases in wages, income increases in incomes, both on the capital income side as well as on the labor income side. To help us understand what all of these trends mean, how they are caused, what we can do about them, we have put together a panel of outstanding experts. I'll introduce them very quickly in the order that they're speaking. They have all very impressive bios, and last night I was looking over the bios and figuring, which parts should I highlight, which one shouldn't. There's just too much to choose from for all four of them, so I'll just go with their titles, and then we'll hand it over. Our first speaker is Martin Eakes. He's the co-founder of SelfHelp, a community development lender in North Carolina, and of its affiliate, the Center for Responsible Lending. Our next speaker is Mark Zandi, chief economist and co-founder of now MoodysEconomy.com. His remarks are followed by Janet Merguia. She's the executive director and chief operating officer of the National Council of La Raza. And our last speaker will be Professor Elizabeth Warren. She's the Leo Gottlieb Professor of Law at Harvard University. And without further delay, let me hand this over to Martin.
Good morning, everyone. I had an organization called SelfHelp that grew from a $77 bake sale to be one of the larger community development lending organizations in the nation. We have about $1 billion in assets and have made $4 to $5 billion of financing to mostly low-income families to become homeowners or small business owners. By 1998, we felt like we had had some progress in helping poor families to enter the middle class by owning what is the most critical asset of all, a first home. In 1998, we came across a fact that really staggered us. We found that there was one finance company in North Carolina that was making more bad loans than we had made in our history, even though we were one of the larger nonprofit lending organizations. We found this one company was causing over 10,000 foreclosures in North Carolina alone and over 150,000 foreclosures nationally across the country. So we felt like we had no choice but to become involved in fighting what has now become known as predatory or abusive lending. In 1998, we worked to put together a coalition that passed an anti-predatory mortgage lending law in North Carolina. You would think that that was the end of capitalism as we know it if you listened to industry outside the borders of North Carolina. In fact, it has accomplished exactly what we wanted to do. We shut down this one lender who was so desperately bad, and we've not had a single borrower who has complained that they can't get access to credit when they need it. First is I want to make the point that debt is basically a moral issue more than an economic issue. Secondly, I want to say that predatory and high-cost debt will become the civil rights issue of this decade. And number three, middle-class foreclosure is coming to a neighborhood near you soon. Number one, debt is a moral issue. There is a reason that every single religion in the world has strict prohibitions against usury. Debt is really a very special product, one that can create a dependent power relationship. So what makes debt so special beyond that? Because there are other products like gambling, prescription drugs, that can also create a dependent relationship. Debt, unlike any of those other products, has its consumer get deeper in trouble simply with the passage of time, with no intervening acts on the part of a debtor. They get deeper in a hole simply with the passage of time. So like prescription drugs, which can be great benefit if used correctly, there needs to be regulation. And if indeed a civilization can be measured by how it treats its bottom 50% economically, I would put forth to you that you can measure how a society is doing with its bottom 50% by examining that society's debt practices. The ivory tower, no regulation whatsoever, extremists will be surprised when they find that the religious conservatives in this country are starting to mobilize to fight against abusive debt practices, because they know that poverty and usury has always been a moral issue to which they're not willing to concede. Predatory and high-cost debt is the civil rights issue of this decade. Maybe it has always been a key civil rights issue. I want to read one quote from Frederick Douglass that was quoted in 1880. He said, "They gave freedmen the machinery of liberty, but denied them the steam to put it in motion. They gave them the uniform of soldiers, but no arms. They called them citizens, but left them subjects. They called them free and almost left them slaves. They did not deprive the old master class of the power of life and death, which was the soul of the relation of master and slave. He who can say to his fellow man, 'You shall serve me or starve,' as a master, and his subject as a slave." He talked about debt and how debt was basically in the South used as a method of perpetuating the dependent relationship that slavery had legally embodied only 10 years earlier than this speech he gave, 15 years earlier in 1880. I want to show you just this graphic. This is a picture of census tracts in Charlotte. It's a little bit hard to see from here, but the very the darker census tracts are those census tracts that are the 20% most heavily concentrated African American and Latino census tracts all across the country. The yellow dots are where the payday lending stores were located in North Carolina before we outlawed payday lending and forced them out of the state. Okay, this is the same picture for Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is where Fort Bragg is located. You see Fort Bragg up in the upper left-hand corner. The darker census tracts, again, are the high concentrations of minorities. And look where the payday lending shops are located. We basically found, doing this mapping nationwide, that if you were in an identifiably minority census tract, you had three times as many payday lending outlets as if you lived in a primarily white census tract. We recently published a study that has been widely reported where we held constant all of the following traits: the borrower traits for credit score, income, ability to document income, loan traits, and basically found that you were 34% more likely to get a high-cost mortgage loan if you were African American or Latino, even when you hold constant credit scores, loan to value, and all the other underwriting risk factors for loans. Okay, I want to jump to the subprime growth in mortgage. So I wanted to use payday lending and then use mortgage lending to say that there have been troubles, there have been targeting in terms of civil rights constituencies, and here is the part of foreclosures coming to a neighborhood near you. First, note that the growth in subprime lending from 1998 was below $100 billion per year. By the end of 2005, it was up to $800 billion per year. One in five of every mortgage loan made in the U.S. was a subprime mortgage. Now, why should that worry you? In 2004 to 2005, the dominant product being offered by subprime mortgage companies was what's called a 2/28 mortgage. The mortgage was fixed rate for 2 years. But at the end of the 2 years, the interest rate would jump to be LIBOR plus 6.5%. LIBOR currently is 5.5. So 5.5 plus 6.5 means that the interest rate will now jump to 12%. In 2003, 2004, when the short-term rates were only 1%, adding 6.5% was a reckless product, in that it meant that interest rate risk had been transferred from lenders who can, in the aggregate, control it, to individual borrowers who can't. But now, to be originating that same product today when LIBOR is at 5.5 means that the borrowers will face in 2 years a 50 to 75% payment shock in every case, even if interest rates do not rise any further. It's going to be a really desperate situation. Okay, one final chart, and this one should terrify you. This is a chart that shows the cumulative foreclosure. This number is almost never reported because it's hard to get. So if you start with 100 loans in year 1998, how many of those loans will be foreclosed and the family lose all of the equity that they built up over a lifetime, over the life of that group of loans? And so if you look at 1998 and carry it forward 7 years, it's up to 10% of the total that's foreclosed. The loans originated in 1999 have an even higher foreclosure rate. The loans originated in 2000 have a higher still foreclosure rate. And 2001, 2002, and 2003 have basically tracked the 2000 trend. So look at 2000. That number is over 14% that have already been foreclosed of all loans originated in the subprime sector in the year 2000. And remember, 2001, 2002, 2003 track exactly the curve for 2000. So we've now had a five-fold, tenfold growth in the number of subprime mortgages, disproportionately focused on minority communities, and the foreclosure rate here is severely understated for what will actually happen. Okay, so we're already at 14% after 5 years. The projected average for the full life will be more like 20% of all subprime loans that are currently being made or that were made in 2000 and beyond will eventually foreclose. And that is severely understated, because in this period of time, the last 5 years, we have the best economic times we have ever had for this lending. Interest rates were very low. Asset values were increasing and growing, which will not happen as interest rates start to rise. And this figure only looks at the foreclosures that happened by the lender who made the loan. So if you were flipped by another lender and you got into a second lender as one of the prepayments, and you ultimately got trapped and didn't get out and you still were a foreclosure, the rate will be somewhere in excess of 40% of the total number of borrowers who got subprime loans who will ultimately become foreclosed. The industry figures you will see will tell you a very different story, but you really have to dig into the numbers. The number that they will show you is, let me tell you what the inventory of foreclosed properties is as a percentage of all outstanding subprime loans. Okay, and that number will come out to be 4%. Well, what an inventory is basically a snapshot that says for all properties that have already been foreclosed and we're holding them before they're resold, it's 4% of the total. That doesn't sound as bad, but you're talking about just a very narrow little slice in time. In conclusion, my message is that we have to deal with the problem of abusive debt because it overwhelms every other policy that we focus on to improve family wealth. $6 billion are lost from payday lending, $10 to $20 billion a year from overdraft fees by bank, $10 billion plus from foreclosed equity on people's homes, and over $10 billion a year in overdraft fees on credit cards. So somewhere in the magnitude of $50 billion are being stripped away from the middle and bottom segments of America's economy. And no amount of savings incentive programs or any other program aimed at building wealth can possibly overcome that problem. It is as if you have a bucket that you are pouring drips into, but the bucket has no bottom whatsoever. And so this issue is one that we simply must address, or we can't really make progress with any other economic justice program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. And for a somewhat different take on the overall debt, I think we're going to turn to Mark Zandi.
Is that why you sat us next to each other?
Duke it out.
Christian, thank you for having me. Derek, thank you. Thank you to the Center for Economic Progress for the opportunity. I have 23 points to make. No, only kidding. Only kidding. I have half, 5 points to make in the next few minutes. Point number one, I do think there are two very distinct households in the economy today, roughly defined by the median household income, which is approximately $50,000 a year. Those households that are in the top half of the distribution of income are doing very well. Incomes are rising strongly. Their balance sheets are pristine. If they have any debt, it's probably a fixed-rate mortgage. They have stocks. They have housing that's appreciated in value. They have retirement assets. They're in good shape. The folks in the bottom half of the income distribution are struggling. Their incomes are not rising after inflation. Their debt loads are high. If they have an asset, it's a new home with little equity. Their balance sheets are about as weak as I've ever seen them. So we have two very distinct households. There are many forces driving this. I think the most important is the decline in interest rates over the past quarter century and the substantive innovation in financial markets and among intermediaries over the past 10, 15 years. With those lower rates, it's become much easier for households to take on leverage. And with financial innovation, it's been very easy for intermediaries to provide that credit to borrowers who are very willing to take it down at these lower rates. A more stable economy has also helped. We've had recessions, but they've been generally quite mild. And with more stable incomes, that's also allowed borrowers to take on more leverage. And lenders are more confident to provide that leverage to borrowers. So all those things have come together to increase leverage among lower-income households. That's point number one. Two very distinct kind of households out there. Point number two, financial pressure on lower-income households will intensify quite substantively going forward. The principal reason is interest rates. Interest rates are rising. The Federal Reserve has tightened policy for 2 years. The funds rate target is 5.25%, probably rise again in August. Long-term rates are up. It's very hard to imagine that interest rates are going to fall appreciably from current levels anytime in the near future. The quarter century decline in interest rates is now over, and interest rates will at best be where they are today and in all likelihood be higher going forward. That means higher debt service, and debt service growth is now running about 8-9% according to the Federal Reserve Board. That's the growth in principal payments and interest payments on all household liabilities, and that's well above income growth, particularly for lower-income households, and therefore the debt service burden is rising. Also, with higher interest rates, the housing market is clearly weakening. One very important factor keeping credit quality together as well as it's been kept together to this point is the very strong housing market, surging housing values and homeowners' equity. That's now coming to an end. Housing values are growing, but slowly, and there are, I think, good prospects for house price declines, flat house prices for an extended period for the next couple, 3 years. So that the housing market won't help. And then third, the job market is good, but it is likely to weaken in the very near term by design. The Reserve is working hard to slow growth, and we'll see that and already have begun to see it in the job market. So the implication is that credit quality, which is actually very, very good in aggregate, probably about as good as it gets, at least through the first quarter of this year, has already begun to erode and will erode measurably over the course of the next couple, 3 years. So that's point number two. Point number three is in the next 2-3 years, my concern is highest for the lower-income new homeowners, people who are first-time home buyers in the last 2-3 years. That's a very large group of people, and I think there's roughly $750 billion worth of mortgage debt outstanding. That's about 8% of all mortgage debt outstanding that is at significant risk of delinquency or default in the next couple of 3 years. That includes those borrowers that have those mortgage borrowers who've taken on a loan for the first time in the last 2-3 years that have less than 10% equity in their home that got an IO or option ARM at a low teaser rate or are subprime. All of those are ARM borrowers, though. So these are borrowers that are new to homeownership, have very little equity, and face payment resets in the next couple, 3 years. And that totals about $750 billion. And those are the groups that are at most risk. Those are lower middle income households in general. Point number four, in the longer run, I think credit problems will intensify, particularly for lower and middle income households, because I think their incomes will be generally constrained and very volatile, largely because of broader economic forces that are firmly entrenched, globalization and technological change. Globalization is a very significant net benefit to our economy, but it does result in losers, and those are lower middle income households with less education and skills that are competing in a much deeper and more competitive labor marketplace, and therefore it's very difficult to envisage that these households are going to experience significant wage gains, certainly wage gains that outpace inflation for any extended period of time. So they're going to have a great deal of difficulty. Their incomes will also be more volatile. I think their jobs are more tenuous. They'll be in and out of the workplace more often because of globalization and technological change. Just let me reinforce a point, though. Globalization and obviously technological change are very significant net benefits to the economy. Higher-income households with educations and skills benefit enormously as they're able to sell their talents to a broader global marketplace. So that's very, very important to realize. And then finally, point number five, the policy response. What we shouldn't do is limit globalization or limit the access to credit. That would be a huge mistake. I've made the point about globalization. The democratization of credit has been very important and very positive. There are clear cases of excess and of abuse, but they are minor in the grand scope of things. The access to credit that's been provided to lower middle income households has been a boon to lower and middle income households. It's allowed them to match their consumption of goods and services with their cash outlays, something that higher income households have always been able to do, but lower income households until recently could not do. And so I think this is very important. Yes, there will be significant increases in delinquency, defaults, and foreclosures, and that's the dark side of all of this, and we haven't really seen the dark side, and we will, but that will pale in comparison to the benefits to the democratization of credit, and any restriction on the access of credit would be a very significant and large mistake, a blunder. What we should do is focus on education, not only in enhancing the skill levels and education attainment of the population so that they can become more competitive in global labor markets, but financial education. I think people don't understand the credit they're taking on. If they did understand the credit they were taking on and the risks that they face, they wouldn't take it on. It's just they don't understand it. And to some degree, the lenders don't understand it either. These are very new products that are being marketed very heavily, and I think it's very important that we have good financial education. And then finally, yes, we should prosecute very aggressively those that abuse the system, those that are predatory lenders. I think that's very important. But to restrict the access to credit would be a very substantive mistake. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm sure we'll come back to the policy differences and the takes on that.
I'm stronger than he is, you know.
Throughout the day and at the end of the session. All right. We have all I see we will have a lot to discuss, and now we will turn over to Elizabeth Warren.
What I want to talk about today is I want to talk about where the money went. We talk about borrowing, but all borrowing did something. Right, you bought something with it, you consume something with it, or it's borrowing for more interest to service the borrowing you already have. Because I think it's absolutely essential to understand this. I think it's important from a policy perspective. Mark Zandi says, gee, this prevents families to smooth out their income consumption over time. Other people say, well, it's just about personal responsibility. It's all about those $200 sneakers and Game Boys. What you're spending money on is relevant to this question at both a moral and an economic level. So I want to talk about it, and I also want to, by talking about it, I want to put this question about debt into a bigger context, into the context of what's happened in a generation. How is it different for young families a generation ago, in the early 1970s, when they were starting out? So the first thing I want to do is I want to talk about how much money is out there for the median income family. This shows how much in inflation-adjusted dollars a fully employed male is earning compared with his counterpart, his father, a generation ago. And what you'll notice is in fully adjusted inflated dollars, it's the same. Men today are making what men made a generation ago. If I did this for a whole century, you would see that it had climbed and it had climbed and it had climbed until the early 1970s, and then it turned into a runway. It just moved flat and smooth. But household income has gone up. So how did household income go up? Well, we all know the answer in this room. That represents the influx of mothers of minor children into the workforce. That's basically what's happened to America. If you want to understand the economics of the last generation, the last quarter of the 20th century, just take a look at that number, because it is about the difference between the odds that a woman today with a child younger than 6 months will be in the workforce are higher than the odds that her mother with a child older than 16 would be in the workforce. There's the big difference. Women have gone in. That's boosted our gross national product. It's had all kinds of effects that we could talk about, social effects. But the one I want to talk about here is that it has brought more money in. So today's family has put, at the median, they have put two people into the workforce, and they have about 68% more income in inflation-adjusted dollars than they had a generation ago. Now, it doesn't look so hot if you only have a one adult household or only one person in the workforce. Notice how we're starting to divide the world in really critical ways. But for those who can put two into the workforce, this is what it looks like. Okay, So the first thing I want to say about this is just stop and think. If I'd been here in the early 1970s, we'd all been in this room, and I had said, I have my crystal ball, here's what's going to happen in the next 30 years, what would you have predicted the world would look like by today? I'll tell you what my prediction would have been. My first prediction would be everyone would want to live in the cities and nobody would live in the suburbs, because I guarantee moms are not going to commute for an hour and a half if they're separated from where their children are. Boy, would I have been wrong. But the second thing I would predict is lots of savings, plenty of vacations, right? Lots of extra income. Let's take a look at savings and debt over that same period of time. Okay, here we go. First one, 1970s, the typical one-earner family was putting away 11% of its take-home pay in savings and paying off 3% in what's called consumer debt, non-mortgage debt. Mostly car payment credit cards. Today's two-income family is, if you've seen the latest numbers, they're actually in the negative savings rate. I'm just going to call them zero, okay, by giving them a little boost, is putting away nothing and carrying about 13% of its pay in consumer debt, car payments, and largely credit card debt. Okay, so think what that means. In the last generation, families have done three things economically. They spent all of the income that their second earner brought in. They spent all of what they used to save, that 11%. And they went into debt so that they're having to spend another 13% to carry the debt that they need to pay off. In other words, they spent, and they spent some more by every analysis I know to do. Okay, so let's take a look at what they spent it on. When I got ready to do these data, I got some help from our folks in the federal government who could actually sit down and break down the data by different kinds of families. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do some comparison on median earning family, mom, dad, and two kids. All right? How much more are they spending today? And when I first ran the numbers, I knew the very first thing I wanted when I got ready to do the categories, I wanted clothing, because I know how much more families spend today on clothing than they spent a generation ago. I've seen those little kids in designer toddler T-shirts, right? There's a designer everything out there. How much more are they spending? Anybody want to make the guess? 32% less than they spent a generation ago. 32% less in inflation-adjusted dollars. And notice, I didn't even do this as a percentage of their rising household income. I did this in flat dollars. They're spending 32% less than they spent a generation ago. Pause for a minute. Not wearing fancy suits, not wearing leather shoes. People don't buy at full-price department stores. They buy at discount. Lots of our stuff is manufactured overseas. Lots of effects for this. Okay, then food. It's sure got to be eating out. With mom out in the workforce, nobody's eating at home anymore. For goodness sakes, we have designer water now that people pay for, right, rather than getting it out of a paper cup. So how much more, including eating out, is today's family spending on food than they spent a generation ago? The answer is 18% less in inflation-adjusted dollars than they spent a generation ago. Once again, the Costco effect or Walmart effect, people, the profit margins have shrunk. People don't shop at neighborhood stores. They buy pasta in bags big enough that you have to bring them home in the back of a pickup truck. People are not, well, think about it, right? People don't eat as much meat as they used to eat. When they eat out, the words always start with bucket of, and right? And the truth is, to fill you up for the calories, it's a pretty good deal financially. So 18% less than the four family of four spent a generation ago. Appliances. This is always a favorite. We didn't have popcorn poppers. We didn't have spread sandwiches. Microwave ovens, right? Microwave ovens evidently can only be said in the term microwave ovens, right? That's where families' money's going. Appliances. This generation compared with a generation ago, 52% less. Appliances last longer than they used to. They are imported. Yep, we have espresso machines, but they ain't costing as much. They're there, but they're cheap. Cars. People like to talk about cars. People now drive SUVs and, you know, the size of a living room, and they have TV sets in them and Corinthian leather, and, right, they have all these fancy, fancy things. What's happened on cars? Per car, 4 year cost of owning an automobile. And I want to be clear here. I am not picking up the latest data, and I think that's what's important. This is not gasoline hikes. This one stops at the end of 2004 on the data. What's happened per car? Answer, down 24%. Okay, so the key part of this is it tells me when we look at consumption items, the ordinary kind of flotsam and jetsam to keep a family going, it's down, down, down. Now put the picture together. So they're spending more, right, on the first three ways we identified, and they're not spending it on this junk. So where did it go? Answer, first big one, mortgages. What a family lays out, I'm not talking about the big commitment, I'm talking about what they lay out on a monthly basis today, or in 2004, compared with what they were laying out at the beginning of the 1970s. There you go, an increase of 76%. And I have to say to you, I'm going to pause here for 1 second, Martin can sing in harmony on this, that 76% is the single scariest number up there. Not only is it a much bigger fraction of a family's income than these other numbers that we're talking about here, this is the one that has the explosion coming in it. It was 76% at the end of 2004 before these mortgages started readjusting for all the adjustable rate mortgages that are going to take off. It was 76% when our interest rates were at their absolute lowest. What else are they spending it on? Let's take a look at their health insurance, up 74%. How about their cars? They spend less per car, but they got two people in the workforce now. So what's happened to their total expenditures on cars? Up 52%. And in order to keep mom in the workforce, they have a new expense that that family never had before, child care. I call it 100% because I don't have any other way to describe it. As you know, we can't do the denominator here by zero. And last one, they pay more on taxes because, after all, whoever you want to count as the second earner is being taxed first dollar at the margin for where the last earner quit earning. All right, so what this tells me is the family budget has shifted in a dramatic and profound way. And here's the slide next, Martin, that tells it all to me. What this slide is in inflation-adjusted dollars. This is the single-earning family. One income back in the early 1970s is on the left. And what you'll notice about this family is the bottom half is those five expenses that I just described. Okay, the mortgage, the health insurance, the car payment, child care, they didn't have any, and their taxes. And the top half is everything else. The things are a little bit flexible. You can spend a little more, you can spend a little less at any given time. Notice what that family was doing back in the early 1970s. That family was spending about half on big fixed incomes that they couldn't do anything about. You either meet them or you move out of your house. You meet them or you give up your health insurance. By the early 2000s, notice how it had shifted. They spend a total of more dollars, but those same five expenses now consume three-quarters of their income, leaving them, here's my favorite part, after both of them have hit the workforce, they are left with less cash in their pockets to cover even the most basic expenses than their parents had a generation ago. Two people in the workforce, less money to spend once you've met your basic expenses. Okay, so I'm going to stop here with just these three thoughts. Debt's up? No kidding. Because debt has become, for these families, the personal social safety net. When anything goes wrong, this family is flat out of options, this two-income family. So it means if somebody gets sick, somebody loses a job, you want to try to educate a child, then you've got to dip into debt. And debt has become that kind of social safety net. I want to quit, though, with this thought, and that is when we've had a profound change like this in families, and now we're about to see one more profound change, and that's the one Martin talks about and Mark talks about. We have a big burst of mortgage foreclosures that are coming our way. If not foreclosures in the formal sense, sales under distress. Sales and getting rid of the house before the mortgage company comes and takes it away. That's going to happen, and it's going to create a political moment. When people in America who are already worried sick about debt, already deeply confused because they believe in personal responsibility, but they also firmly believe that the people in Washington are not on their sides, but are instead on the sides of those in the industry, are going to be ready to hear a new answer. And people in this room are the ones who better have that answer ready.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I wanted to follow up on one particular question. It goes more to like the factual numbers. We have heard a number of times on this panel references to interest-only loans, options arms. I think the data is somewhat contradictory. We think that, yes, clearly people have moved into riskier segments, but I've also heard the other story that people have moved out of these riskier adjust rate, variable interest rate instruments as long-term rates have gone up. And I think that, at least for me, can explain the oddity that we have had a refinancing boom in the face of rising interest rates. And so I want to like follow up a little bit with Mark and Martin and everybody else who wants to chime in on like how much of a real problem are these new financial innovative products?
Just a factual point, refinancing is down quite substantively. The refinancing that's occurring today is measurably lower than a year or two ago, and what's occurring today is cash-out refi. So that's why you're seeing refis up higher than you might anticipate given the rise in interest rates. People are still pulling cash out, but refis are down. I wouldn't characterize it as a boom.
Okay.
Yeah. The IO option arm is... come on in the last couple, 3 years because of affordability. As interest rates began to rise with monetary tightening, affordability weakened rapidly in very active, juiced-up housing markets. Lenders responded, as you would anticipate, trying to keep the market going by not inventing these mortgages. They've been around for many years, but by marketing them very aggressively to first-time home buyers. And that's what we've seen. The IO option arm share of originations is very high in places like California, Florida, the Northeast. It's non-existent in Texas or in the Midwest where affordability is not an issue. So this is a way to keep affordability up and allow first-time buyers to continue to move into the market. These buyers, because they're first-time home buyers in general, are lower-income, lower-middle-income households, and many of them don't understand the mortgages that they've taken down. I'm confident of that because I don't understand the mortgages, and the lenders really don't understand the mortgages. They're very complex instruments that can do very different things under different interest rate scenarios, and thus I do think they're at significant risk of having trouble making mortgage payments when those mortgages reset, when interest rates reset. And it's not insignificant. There's roughly $500 billion in outstanding IO and option arms today. And that's really been accumulated over the last 3 years. And again, it's all low, middle-income households. It's all the homeowners in previously active areas of the country where logic would suggest that prices are going to go flat to down. So this is where we're going to see the default. So I view it as a risk.
Okay. Well, thank you. With that, I would like to open it to the floor. We usually take questions first from the media. There is a mic that will come around. Please state your name and your affiliation. Are there any questions from the media?
Yes, Marcia Kaz with BNA. I was wondering if any of the panelists think that there is a choice that consumers have between being house rich and cash poor and scaling down their expectations of housing in order to have more discretionary money.
The notion when we put it the question that way, scaling down your expectations, is one that envisions people who are spending so much more on housing as having a lot of granite countertops and spa bathrooms and that fifth bedroom or a media room. In fact, the median data, if we just look at the median, where the middle household lives, the big shift in one generation is that they have gone from 5.8 rooms to 6.1 rooms. They have picked up, on average, according to the federal data, either a third bedroom or a second bathroom, but not both, at the middle. They are also more likely today to live in a house that is more than 25 years old. They are four times more likely to live in a house that's more than 25 years old than their parents were, thus incurring a lot more expenses in terms of maintenance and replacement. The reason I identify that is if you look at our own Harvard, the Joint Center on Housing at Harvard, you see the expanding notion of what constitutes housing. What it tells you, though, if you look very carefully at the data, is it only tells you about the new housing that's been brought onto the market. And what that tells you about is there's been a second profound shift in America in the same period of time. Developers stopped building Levittown and started building McMansionville.